I replied to some of his abuse, and he struck me. Some months before, he had pitched me downstairs in a fit of passion, and the injury I received was so serious that I was unable to turn myself in bed for many days. He then said, "Linda, I swear by God I will never raise my hand against you again," but I knew that he would forget his promise. After he discovered my situation, he was like a restless spirit from the pit. He came every day, and I was subjected to such insults as no pen can describe. I would not describe them if I could. They were too low, too revolting. I tried to keep them from my grandmother's knowledge as much as I could. I knew she had enough to sadden her life without having my troubles to bear. When she saw the doctor treat me with violence and heard him utter oaths terrible enough to palsy a man's tongue, she could not always hold her peace. It was natural and motherlike that she should try to defend me, but it only made matters worse. When they told me my newborn babe was a girl, my heart was heavier than it had ever been before. Slavery is terrible for men, but it is far more terrible for women. Superadded to the burden common to all, they have wrongs and sufferings and mortifications peculiarly their own. Dr. Flint had sworn that he would make me suffer, to my last day, for this new crime against him, as he called it. And as long as he had me in his power, he kept his word. On the fourth day after the birth of my babe, he entered my room suddenly and commanded me to rise and bring my baby to him. The nurse who took care of me had gone out of the room to prepare some nourishment, and I was alone. There was no alternative. I rose, took up my babe, and crossed the room to where he sat. "Now stand there," he said, "till I tell you to go back." My child bore a strong resemblance to her father and to the deceased Mrs. Sands, her grandmother. He noticed this, and while I stood before him, trembling with weakness, he heaped upon me and my little one every vile epithet he could think of. Even the grandmother in her grave did not escape his curses. In the midst of his vituperations, I fainted at his feet. This recalled him to his senses. He took the baby from my arms, laid it on the bed, dashed cold water in my face, took me up, and shook me violently to restore my consciousness before anyone entered the room. Just then, my grandmother came in, and he hurried out of the house. I suffered in consequence of this treatment, but I begged my friends to let me die rather than send for the doctor. There was nothing I dreaded so much as his presence. My life was spared, and I was glad for the sake of my little ones. Had it not been for these ties to life, I should have been glad to be released by death, though I had lived only 19 years. Always it gave me a pang that my children had no lawful claim to a name. Their father offered his, but if I had wished to accept the offer, I dared not while my master lived. Moreover, I knew it would not be accepted at their baptism. A Christian name they were at least entitled to, and we resolved to call my boy for our dear good Benjamin, who had gone far away from us. My grandmother belonged to the church, and she was very desirous of having the children christened. I knew Dr. Flint would forbid it, and I did not venture to attempt it. But chance favored me. He was called to visit a patient out of town, and was obliged to be absent during Sunday. "Now is the time," said my grandmother. "We will take the children to church and have them christened." When I entered the church, recollections of my mother came over me, and I felt subdued in spirit. There she had presented me for baptism without any reason to feel ashamed. She had been married and had such legal rights as slavery allows to a slave. The vows had at least been sacred to her, and she had never violated them. I was glad she was not alive to know under what different circumstances her grandchildren were presented for baptism. Why had my lot been so different from my mother's? Her master had died when she was a child, and she remained with her mistress till she married. She was never in the power of any master, and thus she escaped one class of the evils that generally fall upon slaves. When my baby was about to be christened, the former mistress of my father, stepped up to me and proposed to give it her Christian name. To this, I added the surname of my father, who had himself no legal right to it, for my grandfather on the paternal side was a white gentleman. What tangled skeins are the genealogies of slavery! I loved my father, but it mortified me to be obliged to bestow his name on my children. When we left the church, my father's old mistress invited me to go home with her. She clasped a gold chain round my baby's neck. I thanked her for this kindness, but I did not like the emblem. I wanted no chain to be fastened on my daughter, not even if its links were of gold. How earnestly I prayed that she might never feel the weight of slavery's chain, whose iron entereth into the soul. 15. Continued persecutions. My children grew finely, and Dr. Flint would often say to me, with an exulting smile, "These brats will bring me a handsome sum of money one of these days." I thought to myself that, God being my helper, they should never pass into his hands. It seemed to me I would rather see them killed than have them given up to his power. The money for the freedom of myself and my children could be obtained, but I derived no advantage from that circumstance. Dr. Flint loved money, but he loved power more. After much discussion, my friends resolved on making another trial. There was a slaveholder about to leave for Texas, and he was commissioned to buy me. He was to begin with $900 and go up to 12. My master refused his offers. "Sir," said he, "she don't belong to me. She is my daughter's property, and I have no right to sell her. I mistrust that you come from her paramour. If so, you may tell him that he cannot buy her for any money. Neither can he buy her children." The doctor came to see me the next day, and my heart beat quicker as he entered. I never had seen the old man tread with so majestic a step. He seated himself and looked at me with withering scorn. My children had learned to be afraid of him. The little one would shut her eyes and hide her face on my shoulder whenever she saw him, and Benny, who was now nearly 5 years old, often inquired, "What makes that bad man come here so many times? Does he want to hurt us?" I would clasp the dear boy in my arms, trusting that he would be free before he was old enough to solve the problem. And now, as the doctor sat there so grim and silent, the child left his play and came and nestled up by me. At last my tormentor spoke. "So you are left in disgust, are you?" said he. "It is no more than I expected. You remember I told you years ago that you would be treated so. So he is tired of you. Ha, ha, ha. The virtuous madam don't like to hear about it, does she? Ha, ha, ha." There was a sting in his calling me virtuous madam. I no longer had the power of answering him as I had formerly done. He continued, "So it seems you are trying to get up another intrigue. Your new paramour came to me and offered to buy you, but you may be assured you will not succeed. You are mine, and you shall be mine for life. There lives no human being that can take you out of slavery. I would have done it, but you rejected my kind offer." I told him I did not wish to get up any intrigue, that I had never seen the man who offered to buy me. "Do you tell me I lie?" exclaimed he, dragging me from my chair. "Will you say again that you never saw that man?" I answered, "I do say so." He clenched my arm with a volley of oaths. Ben began to scream, and I told him to go to his grandmother. "Don't you stir a step, you little wretch," said he. The child drew nearer to me and put his arms round me as if he wanted to protect me. This was too much for my enraged master. He caught him up and hurled him across the room. I thought he was dead and rushed towards him to take him up. "Not yet," exclaimed the doctor. "Let him lie there till he comes to." "Let me go, let me go," I screamed, "or I will raise the whole house." I struggled and got away, but he clinched me again. Somebody opened the door and he released me. I picked up my insensible child, and when I turned, my tormentor was gone. Anxiously, I bent over the little form, so pale and still. And when the brown eyes at last opened, I don't know whether I was very happy. All the doctor's former persecutions were renewed. He came, morning, noon, and night. No jealous lover ever watched a rival more closely than he watched me and the unknown slaveholder, with whom he accused me of wishing to get up an intrigue. When my grandmother was out of the way, he searched every room to find him. In one of his visits, he happened to find a young girl, whom he had sold to a trader a few days previous. His statement was that he sold her because she had been too familiar with the overseer. She had had a bitter life with him and was glad to be sold. She had no mother and no near ties. She had been torn from all her family years before. A few friends had entered into bonds for her safety, if the trader would allow her to spend with them the time that intervened between her sale and the gathering up of his human stock. Such a favor was rarely granted. It saved the trader the expense of board and jail fees, and though the amount was small, it was a weighty consideration in a slave trader's mind. Dr. Flint always had an aversion to meeting slaves after he had sold them. He ordered Rose out of the house, but he was no longer her master, and she took no notice of him. For once, the crushed Rose was the conqueror. His gray eyes flashed angrily upon her, but that was the extent of his power. "How came this girl here?" he exclaimed. "What right had you to allow it when you knew I had sold her?" I answered, "This is my grandmother's house, and Rose came to see her. I have no right to turn anybody out of doors that comes here for honest purposes." He gave me the blow that would have fallen upon Rose if she had still been his slave. My grandmother's attention had been attracted by loud voices, and she entered in time to see a second blow dealt. She was not a woman to let such an outrage, in her own house, go unrebuked. The doctor undertook to explain that I had been insolent. Her indignant feelings rose higher and higher, and finally boiled over in words. "Get out of my house," she exclaimed. "Go home and take care of your wife and children, and you will have enough to do without watching my family." He threw the birth of my children in her face and accused her of sanctioning the life I was leading. She told him I was living with her by compulsion of his wife, that he needn't accuse her, for he was the one to blame. He was the one who had caused all the trouble. She grew more and more excited as she went on. "I tell you what, Dr. Flint," said she, "you ain't got many more years to live, and you better be saying your prayers. It will take 'em all, and more, too, to wash the dirt off your soul." "Do you know whom you are talking to?" he exclaimed. She replied, "Yes, I know very well who I'm talking to." He left the house in a great rage. I looked at my grandmother. Our eyes met. Their angry expression had passed away, but she looked sorrowful and weary. Weary of incessant strife. I wondered that it did not lessen her love for me, but if it did, she never showed it. She was always kind, always ready to sympathize with my troubles. There might have been peace and contentment in that humble home if it had not been for the demon slavery. The winter passed undisturbed by the doctor. The beautiful spring came, and when nature resumes her loveliness, the human soul is apt to revive also. My drooping hopes came to life again with the flowers. I was dreaming of freedom again, more for my children's sake than my own. I planned, and I planned. Obstacles hid against plans. There seemed no way of overcoming them, and yet I hoped. Back came the wily doctor. I was not at home when he called. A friend had invited me to a small party, and to gratify her I went. To my great consternation, a messenger came in haste to say that Dr. Flint was at my grandmother's and insisted on seeing me. They did not tell him where I was, or he would have come and raised a disturbance in my friend's house. They sent me a dark wrapper. I threw it on and hurried home. My speed did not save me. The doctor had gone away in anger. I dreaded the morning, but I could not delay it. It came, warm and bright. At an early hour, the doctor came and asked me where I had been last night. I told him. He did not believe me, and sent to my friend's house to ascertain the facts. He came in the afternoon to assure me he was satisfied that I had spoken the truth. He seemed to be in a facetious mood, and I expected some jeers were coming. "I suppose you need some recreation," said he, "but I am surprised at your being there, among those Negroes. It was not the place for you. Are you allowed to visit such people?" I understood this covert fling at the white gentleman who was my friend, but I merely replied, "I went to visit my friends, and any company they keep is good enough for me." He went on to say, "I have seen very little of you of late, but my interest in you is unchanged. When I said I would have no more mercy on you, I was rash. I recall my words, Linda. You desire freedom for yourself and your children, and you can obtain it only through me. If you agree to what I am about to propose, you and they shall be free. There must be no communication of any kind between you and their father. I will procure a cottage where you and the children can live together. Your labor shall be light, such as sewing for my family. Think what is offered you, Linda. A home and freedom. Let the past be forgotten. If I have been harsh with you at times, your willfulness drove me to it. You know I exact obedience from my own children, and I consider you as yet a child." He paused for an answer, but I remained silent. "Why don't you speak?" said he. "What more do you wait for?" "Nothing, sir." "Then you accept my offer?" "No, sir." His anger was ready to break loose, but he succeeded in curbing it and replied, "You have answered without thought, but I must let you know there are two sides to my proposition. If you reject the bright side, you will be obliged to take the dark one. You must either accept my offer, or you and your children shall be sent to your young master's plantation, there to remain till your young mistress is married, and your children shall fare like the rest of the Negro children. I give you a week to consider it." He was shrewd, but I knew he was not to be trusted. I told him I was ready to give my answer now. "I will not receive it now," he replied. "You act too much from impulse. Remember that you and your children can be free a week from today, if you choose." On what a monstrous chance hung the destiny of my children. I knew that my master's offer was a snare, and that if I entered it, escape would be impossible. As for his promise, I knew him so well that I was sure if he gave me free papers, they would be so managed as to have no legal value. The alternative was inevitable. I resolved to go to the plantation. But then I thought how completely I should be in his power, and the prospect was appalling. Even if I should kneel before him and implore him to spare me for the sake of my children, I knew he would spurn me with his foot, and my weakness would be his triumph. Before the week expired, I heard that young Mr. Flint was about to be married to a lady of his own stamp. I foresaw the position I should occupy in his establishment. I had once been sent to the plantation for punishment, and fear of the son had induced the father to recall me very soon. My mind was made up. I was resolved that I would foil my master and save my children, or I would perish in the attempt. I kept my plans to myself. I knew that friends would try to dissuade me from them, and I would not wound their feelings by rejecting their advice. On the decisive day, the doctor came and said he hoped I had made a wise choice. "I am ready to go to the plantation, sir," I replied. "Have you thought how important your decision is to your children?" said he. I told him I had. "Very well. Go to the plantation, and my curse go with you," he replied. "Your boy shall be put to work, and he shall soon be sold, and your girl shall be raised for the purpose of selling well. Go your own ways." He left the room with curses, not to be repeated. As I stood rooted to the spot, my grandmother came and said, "Linda, child, what did you tell him?" I answered that I was going to the plantation. "Must you go?" said she. "Can't something be done to stop it?" I told her it was useless to try, but she begged me not to give up. She said she would go to the doctor and remind him how long and how faithfully she had served in the family, and how she had taken her own baby from her breast to nourish his wife. She would tell him I had been out of the family so long they would not miss me, that she would pay them for my time, and the money would procure a woman who had more strength for the situation than I had. I begged her not to go, but she persisted in saying, "He will listen to me, Linda." She went, and was treated as I expected. He coolly listened to what she said, but denied her request. He told her that what he did was for my good, that my feelings were entirely above my situation, and that on the plantation, I would receive treatment that was suitable to my behavior. My grandmother was much cast down. I had my secret hopes, but I must fight my battle alone. I had a woman's pride and a mother's love for my children, and I resolved that out of the darkness of this hour, a brighter dawn should rise for them. My master had power and law on his side. I had a determined will. There is might in each. 16. Scenes at the Plantation. Early the next morning, I left my grandmother's with my youngest child. My boy was ill, and I left him behind. I had many sad thoughts as the old wagon jolted on. Hitherto I had suffered alone. Now my little one was to be treated as a slave. As we drew near the great house, I thought of the time when I was formerly sent there out of revenge. I wondered for what purpose I was now sent. I could not tell. I resolved to obey orders so far as duty required, but within myself I determined to make my stay as short as possible. Mr. Flint was waiting to receive us and told me to follow him upstairs to receive orders for the day. My little Ellen was left below in the kitchen. It was a change for her, who had always been so carefully tended. My young master said she might amuse herself in the yard. This was kind of him, since the child was hateful to his sight. My task was to fit up the house for the reception of the bride. In the midst of sheets, tablecloths, towels, drapery, and carpeting, my head was as busy planning as were my fingers with a needle. At noon, I was allowed to go to Ellen. She had sobbed herself to sleep. I heard Mr. Flint say to a neighbor, "I've got her down here, and I'll soon take the town notions out of her head. My father is partly to blame for her nonsense. He ought to have broke her in long ago." The remark was made within my hearing, and it would have been quite as manly to have made it to my face. He had said things to my face which might or might not have surprised his neighbor if he had known of them. He was a chip of the old block. I resolved to give him no cause to accuse me of being too much of a lady, so far as work was concerned. I worked day and night with wretchedness before me. When I lay down beside my child, I felt how much easier it would be to see her die than to see her master beat her about, as I daily saw him beat other little ones. The spirit of the mothers was so crushed by the lash that they stood by without courage to remonstrate. How much more must I suffer before I should be broke in to that degree? I wished to appear as contented as possible. Sometimes I had an opportunity to send a few lines home, and this brought up recollections that made it difficult, for a time, to seem calm and indifferent to my lot. Notwithstanding my efforts, I saw that Mr. Flint regarded me with a suspicious eye. Ellen broke down under the trials of her new life. Separated from me, with no one to look after her, she wandered about and in a few days cried herself sick. One day she sat under the window where I was at work, crying that weary cry which makes a mother's heart bleed. I was obliged to steel myself to bear it. After a while it ceased. I looked out, and she was gone. As it was near noon, I ventured to go down in search of her. The great house was raised 2 feet above the ground. I looked under it and saw her about midway, fast asleep. I crept under and drew her out. As I held her in my arms, I thought how well it would be for her if she never waked up, and I uttered my thought aloud. I was startled to hear someone say, "Did you speak to me?" I looked up and saw Mr. Flint standing beside me. He said nothing further, but turned, frowning, away. That night, he sent Ellen a biscuit and a cup of sweetened milk. This generosity surprised me. I learned afterwards that in the afternoon he had killed a large snake which crept from under the house, and I supposed that incident had prompted his unusual kindness. The next morning, the old cart was loaded with shingles for town. I put Ellen into it and sent her to her grandmother. Mr. Flint said I ought to have asked his permission. I told him the child was sick and required attention, which I had no time to give. He let it pass, for he was aware I had accomplished much work in a little time. I had been 3 weeks on the plantation when I planned a visit home. It must be at night, after everybody was in bed. I was 6 miles from town, and the road was very dreary. I was to go with a young man who, I knew, often stole to town to see his mother. One night, when all was quiet, we started. Fear gave speed to our steps, and we were not long in performing the journey. I arrived at my grandmother's. Her bedroom was on the first floor, and the window was open, the weather being warm. I spoke to her, and she awoke. She let me in and closed the window, lest some late passerby should see me. A light was brought, and the whole household gathered round me, some smiling and some crying. I went to look at my children and thanked God for their happy sleep. The tears fell as I leaned over them. As I moved to leave, Benny stirred. I turned back and whispered, "Mother is here." After digging at his eyes with his little fist, they opened, and he sat up in bed looking at me curiously. Having satisfied himself that it was I, he exclaimed, "Oh, Mother, you ain't dead, are you? They didn't cut off your head at the plantation, did they?" My time was up too soon, and my guide was waiting for me. I laid Benny back in his bed and dried his tears by a promise to come again soon. Rapidly, we retraced our steps back to the plantation. About halfway, we were met by a company of 4 patrols. Luckily, we heard their horses' hoofs before they came in sight, and we had time to hide behind a large tree. They passed, hallooing and shouting in a manner that indicated a recent carousal. How thankful we were that they had not their dogs with them. We hastened our footsteps, and when we arrived on the plantation, we heard the sound of the handmill. The slaves were grinding their corn. We were safely in the house before the horn summoned them to their labor. I divided my little parcel of food with my guide, knowing that he had lost the chance of grinding his corn and must toil all day in the field. Mr. Flint often took an inspection of the house to see that no one was idle. The entire management of the work was trusted to me because he knew nothing about it, and rather than hire a superintendent, he contented himself with my arrangements. He had often urged upon his father the necessity of having me at the plantation to take charge of his affairs and make clothes for the slaves, but the old man knew him too well to consent to that arrangement. When I had been working a month at the plantation, the great-aunt of Mr. Flint came to make him a visit. This was the good old lady who paid $50 for my grandmother for the purpose of making her free when she stood on the auction block. My grandmother loved this old lady, whom we all called Miss Fanny. She often came to take tea with us. On such occasions, the table was spread with a snow-white cloth, and the china cups and silver spoons were taken from the old-fashioned buffet. There were hot muffins, tea rusks, and delicious sweetmeats. My grandmother kept 2 cows, and the fresh cream was Miss Fanny's delight. She invariably declared that it was the best in town. The old ladies had cozy times together. They would work and chat, and sometimes while talking over old times, their spectacles would get dim with tears and would have to be taken off and wiped. When Miss Fanny bade us goodbye, her bag was filled with grandmother's best cakes, and she was urged to come again soon. There had been a time when Dr. Flint's wife came to take tea with us, and when her children were also sent to have a feast of Aunt Marthy's nice cooking. But after I became an object of her jealousy and spite, she was angry with Grandmother for giving a shelter to me and my children. She would not even speak to her in the street. This wounded my grandmother's feelings, for she could not retain ill will against the woman whom she had nourished with her milk when a babe. The doctor's wife would gladly have prevented our intercourse with Miss Fanny if she could have done it, but fortunately she was not dependent on the bounty of the Flints. She had enough to be independent, and that is more than can ever be gained from charity, however lavish it may be. Miss Fanny was endeared to me by many recollections, and I was rejoiced to see her at the plantation. The warmth of her large, loyal heart made the house seem pleasanter while she was in it. She stayed a week, and I had many talks with her. She said her principal object in coming was to see how I was treated and whether anything could be done for me. She inquired whether she could help me in any way. I told her I believed not. She condoled with me in her own peculiar way, saying she wished that I and all my grandmother's family were at rest in our graves, for not until then should she feel any peace about us. The good old soul did not dream that I was planning to bestow peace upon her with regard to myself and my children, not by death, but by securing our freedom. Again and again I had traversed those dreary 12 miles to and from the town, and all the way I was meditating upon some means of escape for myself and my children. My friends had made every effort that ingenuity could devise to effect our purchase, but all their plans had proved abortive. Dr. Flint was suspicious and determined not to loosen his grasp upon us. I could have made my escape alone, but it was more for my helpless children than for myself that I longed for freedom. Though the boon would have been precious to me, above all price, I would not have taken it at the expense of leaving them in slavery. Every trial I endured, every sacrifice I made for their sakes, drew them closer to my heart and gave me fresh courage to beat back the dark waves that rolled and rolled over me in a seemingly endless night of storms. The 6 weeks were nearly completed when Mr. Flint's bride was expected to take possession of her new home. The arrangements were all completed, and Mr. Flint said I had done well. He expected to leave home on Saturday and return with his bride the following Wednesday. After receiving various orders from him, I ventured to ask permission to spend Sunday in town. It was granted, for which favor I was thankful. It was the first I had ever asked of him, and I intended it should be the last. I needed more than one night to accomplish the project I had in view, but the whole of Sunday would give me an opportunity. I spent the Sabbath with my grandmother. A calmer, more beautiful day never came down out of heaven. To me, it was a day of conflicting emotions. Perhaps it was the last day I should ever spend under that dear old sheltering roof. Perhaps these were the last talks I should ever have with a faithful old friend of my whole life. Perhaps it was the last time I and my children should be together. Well, better so, I thought, than that they should be slaves. I knew the doom that awaited my fair baby in slavery, and I determined to save her from it or perish in the attempt. I went to make this vow at the graves of my poor parents in the burying ground of the slaves. There the wicked cease from troubling, and there the weary be at rest. There the prisoners rest together. They hear not the voice of the oppressor. The servant is free from his master. I knelt by the graves of my parents and thanked God, as I had often done before, that they had not lived to witness my trials or to mourn over my sins. I had received my mother's blessing when she died, and in many an hour of tribulation I had seemed to hear her voice, sometimes chiding me, sometimes whispering loving words into my wounded heart. I have shed many and bitter tears to think that when I am gone from my children, they cannot remember me with such entire satisfaction as I remembered my mother. The graveyard was in the woods, and twilight was coming on. Nothing broke the death-like stillness except the occasional twitter of a bird. My spirit was overawed by the solemnity of the scene. For more than 10 years I had frequented this spot, but never had it seemed to me so sacred as now. A black stump at the head of my mother's grave was all that remained of a tree my father had planted. His grave was marked by a small wooden board bearing his name, the letters of which were nearly obliterated. I knelt down and kissed them, and poured forth a prayer to God for guidance and support in the perilous step I was about to take. As I passed the wreck of the old meeting house, where, before Nat Turner's time, the slaves had been allowed to meet for worship, I seemed to hear my father's voice come from it, bidding me not to tarry till I reached freedom or the grave. I rushed on with renovated hopes. My trust in God had been strengthened by that prayer among the graves. My plan was to conceal myself at the house of a friend and remain there a few weeks till the search was over. My hope was that the doctor would get discouraged and, for fear of losing my value and also of subsequently finding my children among the missing, he would consent to sell us, and I knew somebody would buy us. I had done all in my power to make my children comfortable during the time I expected to be separated from them. I was packing my things when Grandmother came into the room and asked what I was doing. "I am putting my things in order," I replied. I tried to look and speak cheerfully, but her watchful eye detected something beneath the surface. She drew me towards her and asked me to sit down. She looked earnestly at me and said, "Linda, do you want to kill your old grandmother? Do you mean to leave your little helpless children? I am old now and cannot do for your babies as I once did for you." I replied that if I went away, perhaps their father would be able to secure their freedom. "Ah, my child," said she, "don't trust too much to him. Stand by your own children and suffer with them till death. Nobody respects a mother who forsakes her children, and if you leave them, you will never have a happy moment. If you go, you will make me miserable the short time I have to live. You would be taken and brought back, and your sufferings would be dreadful. Remember poor Benjamin. Do give it up, Linda. Try to bear a little longer. Things may turn out better than we expect." My courage failed me, in view of the sorrow I should bring on that faithful, loving old heart. I promised that I would try longer, and that I would take nothing out of her house without her knowledge. Whenever the children climbed on my knee or laid their heads on my lap, she would say, "Poor little souls, what would you do without a mother? She don't love you as I do." And she would hug them to her own bosom, as if to reproach me for my want of affection. But she knew all the while that I loved them better than my life. I slept with her that night, and it was the last time. The memory of it haunted me for many a year. On Monday, I returned to the plantation and busied myself with preparations for the important day. Wednesday came. It was a beautiful day, and the faces of the slaves were as bright as the sunshine. The poor creatures were merry. They were expecting little presents from the bride and hoping for better times under her administration. I had no such hopes for them. I knew that the young wives of slaveholders often thought their authority and importance would be best established and maintained by cruelty, and what I had heard of young Mrs. Flint gave me no reason to expect that her rule over them would be less severe than that of the master and overseer. Truly, the colored race are the most cheerful and forgiving people on the face of the earth. That their masters sleep in safety is owing to their superabundance of heart, and yet they look upon their sufferings with less pity than they would bestow on those of a horse or a dog. I stood at the door with others to receive the bridegroom and bride. She was a handsome, delicate-looking girl, and her face flushed with emotion at sight of her new home. I thought it likely that visions of a happy future were rising before her. It made me sad, for I knew how soon clouds would come over her sunshine. She examined every part of the house and told me she was delighted with the arrangements I had made. I was afraid old Mrs. Flint had tried to prejudice her against me, and I did my best to please her. All passed off smoothly for me until dinner time arrived. I did not mind the embarrassment of waiting on a dinner party for the first time in my life, half so much as I did the meeting with Dr. Flint and his wife, who would be among the guests. It was a mystery to me why Mrs. Flint had not made her appearance at the plantation during all the time I was putting the house in order. I had not met her face to face for 5 years, and I had no wish to see her now. She was a praying woman, and doubtless considered my present position a special answer to her prayers. Nothing could please her better than to see me humbled and trampled upon. I was just where she would have me, in the power of a hard, unprincipled master. She did not speak to me when she took her seat at table, but her satisfied, triumphant smile, when I handed her plate, was more eloquent than words. The old doctor was not so quiet in his demonstrations. He ordered me here and there, and spoke with peculiar emphasis when he said, "Your mistress!" I was drilled like a disgraced soldier. When all was over and the last key turned, I sought my pillow, thankful that God had appointed a season of rest for the weary. The next day, my new mistress began her housekeeping. I was not exactly appointed maid of all work, but I was to do whatever I was told. Monday evening came. It was always a busy time. On that night, the slaves received their weekly allowance of food. 3 pounds of meat, a peck of corn, and perhaps a dozen herring were allowed to each man. Women received 1.5 pounds of meat, a peck of corn, and the same number of herring. Children over 12 years old had half the allowance of the women. The meat was cut and weighed by the foreman of the field hands and piled on planks before the meat house. Then the second foreman went behind the building, and when the first foreman called out, "Who takes this piece of meat?" he answered by calling somebody's name. This method was resorted to as a means of preventing partiality in distributing the meat. The young mistress came out to see how things were done on her plantation, and she soon gave a specimen of her character. Among those in waiting for their allowance was a very old slave who had faithfully served the Flint family through 3 generations. When he hobbled up to get his bit of meat, the mistress said he was too old to have any allowance, that when niggers were too old to work, they ought to be fed on grass. Poor old man. He suffered much before he found rest in the grave. My mistress and I got along very well together. At the end of a week, old Mrs. Flint made us another visit and was closeted a long time with her daughter-in-law. I had my suspicions what was the subject of the conference. The old doctor's wife had been informed that I could leave the plantation on one condition, and she was very desirous to keep me there. If she had trusted me, as I deserved to be trusted by her, she would have had no fears of my accepting that condition. When she entered her carriage to return home, she said to young Mrs. Flint, "Don't neglect to send for them as quick as possible." My heart was on the watch all the time, and I at once concluded that she spoke of my children. The doctor came the next day, and as I entered the room to spread the tea table, I heard him say, "Don't wait any longer. Send for them tomorrow." I saw through the plan. They thought my children's being there would fetter me to the spot, and that it was a good place to break us all into abject submission to our lot as slaves. After the doctor left, a gentleman called, who had always manifested friendly feelings towards my grandmother and her family. Mr. Flint carried him over the plantation to show him the results of labor performed by men and women who were unpaid, miserably clothed, and half-famished. The cotton crop was all they thought of. It was duly admired, and the gentleman returned with specimens to show his friends. I was ordered to carry water to wash his hands. As I did so, he said, "Linda, how do you like your new home?" I told him I liked it as well as I expected. He replied, "They don't think you are contented, and tomorrow they're going to bring your children to be with you. I am sorry for you, Linda. I hope they will treat you kindly." I hurried from the room, unable to thank him. My suspicions were correct. My children were to be brought to the plantation to be broke in. To this day, I feel grateful to the gentleman who gave me this timely information. It nerved me to immediate action. 17. The Flight. Mr. Flint was hard pushed for house servants, and rather than lose me, he had restrained his malice. I did my work faithfully, though not, of course, with a willing mind. They were evidently afraid I should leave them. Mr. Flint wished that I should sleep in the great house instead of the servants' quarters. His wife agreed to the proposition, but said I mustn't bring my bed into the house because it would scatter feathers on her carpet. I knew when I went there that they would never think of such a thing as furnishing a bed of any kind for me and my little ones. I therefore carried my own bed, and now I was forbidden to use it. I did as I was ordered. But now that I was certain my children were to be put in their power in order to give them a stronger hold on me, I resolved to leave them that night. I remembered the grief this step would bring upon my dear old grandmother, and nothing less than the freedom of my children would have induced me to disregard her advice. I went about my evening work with trembling steps. Mr. Flint twice called from his chamber door to inquire why the house was not locked up. I replied that I had not done my work.
"You have had time enough to do it," said he. "Take care how you answer me."
I shut all the windows, locked all the doors, and went up to the third story to wait till midnight. How long those hours seemed, and how fervently I prayed that God would not forsake me in this hour of utmost need. I was about to risk everything on the throw of a die, and if I failed, oh, what would become of me and my poor children? They would be made to suffer for my fault. At 12:30, I stole softly downstairs. I stopped on the second floor, thinking I heard a noise. I felt my way down into the parlor and looked out of the window. The night was so intensely dark that I could see nothing. I raised the window very softly and jumped out. Large drops of rain were falling, and the darkness bewildered me. I dropped on my knees and breathed a short prayer to God for guidance and protection. I groped my way to the road and rushed towards the town with almost lightning speed. I arrived at my grandmother's house, but dared not see her. She would say, "Linda, you are killing me," and I knew that would unnerve me. I tapped softly at the window of a room occupied by a woman who had lived in the house several years. I knew she was a faithful friend and could be trusted with my secret. I tapped several times before she heard me. At last, she raised the window and I whispered, "Sally, I have run away. Let me in, quick." She opened the door softly and said in low tones, "For God's sake, don't. Your grandmother is trying to buy you into cheering. Mr. Sands was here last week. He told her he was going away on business, but he wanted her to go ahead about buying you into cheering, and he would help her all he could. Don't run away, Linda. Your grandmother's all bowed down with trouble now." I replied, "Sally, they're going to carry my children to the plantation tomorrow, and they will never sell them to anybody so long as they have me in their power. Now, would you advise me to go back?"
"No, child, no," answers she. "When they finds you's gone, they don't want to plague them children. But where's you going to hide? They knows every inch of this house."
I told her I had a hiding place, and that was all it was best for her to know. I asked her to go into my room as soon as it was light and take all my clothes out of my trunk and pack them in hers, for I knew Mr. Flint and the constable would be there early to search my room. I feared the sight of my children would be too much for my full heart, but I could not go into the uncertain future without one last look. I bent over the bed where lay my little Benny and baby Ellen. Poor little ones, fatherless and motherless. Memories of their father came over me. He wanted to be kind to them, but they were not all to him as they were to my womanly heart. I knelt and prayed for the innocent little sleepers. I kissed them lightly and turned away. As I was about to open the street door, Sally laid her hand on my shoulder and said, "Linda, is you gone all alone? Let me call your uncle." "No, Sally," I replied. "I want no one to be brought into trouble on my account." I went forth into the darkness and rain. I ran on till I came to the house of the friend who was to conceal me. Early the next morning, Mr. Flint was at my grandmother's inquiring for me. She told him she had not seen me and supposed I was at the plantation. He watched her face narrowly and said, "Don't you know anything about her running off?" She assured him that she did not. He went on to say, "Last night she ran off without the least provocation. We had treated her very kindly. My wife liked her. She will soon be found and brought back. Are her children with you?" When told that they were, he said, "I am very glad to hear that. If they are here, she cannot be far off. If I find out that any of my niggers have had anything to do with this damn business, I'll give them 500 lashes." As he started to go to his father's, he turned round and added, persuasively, "Let her be brought back, and she shall have her children to live with her."
The tidings made the old doctor rave and storm at a furious rate. It was a busy day for them. My grandmother's house was searched from top to bottom. As my trunk was empty, they concluded I had taken my clothes with me. Before 10 o'clock, every vessel northward bound was thoroughly examined, and the law against harboring fugitives was read to all on board. At night, a watch was set over the town. Knowing how distressed my grandmother would be, I wanted to send her a message, but it could not be done. Everyone who went in or out of her house was closely watched. The doctor said he would take my children, unless she became responsible for them, which of course she willingly did. The next day was spent in searching. Before night, the following advertisement was posted at every corner and in every public place for miles around. $300 reward. Ran away from the subscriber, an intelligent, bright, mulatto girl named Linda, 21 years of age, 5 feet 4 inches high, dark eyes and black hair inclined to curl, but it can be made straight, has a decayed spot on a front tooth. She can read and write, and in all probability will try to get to the Free States. All persons are forbidden, under penalty of law, to harbor or employ said slave. $150 will be given to whoever takes her in the state, and $300 if taken out of the state and delivered to me or lodged in jail. Dr. Flint. 18 months of peril. The search for me was kept up with more perseverance than I had anticipated. I began to think that escape was impossible. I was in great anxiety lest I should implicate the friend who harbored me. I knew the consequences would be frightful, and much as I dreaded being caught, even that seemed better than causing an innocent person to suffer for kindness to me. A week had passed in terrible suspense when my pursuers came into such close vicinity that I concluded they had tracked me to my hiding place. I flew out of the house and concealed myself in a thicket of bushes. There I remained in an agony of fear for 2 hours. Suddenly, a reptile of some kind seized my leg. In my fright, I struck a blow which loosened its hold, but I could not tell whether I had killed it. It was so dark, I could not see what it was. I only knew it was something cold and slimy. The pain I felt soon indicated that the bite was poisonous. I was compelled to leave my place of concealment, and I groped my way back into the house. The pain had become intense, and my friend was startled by my look of anguish. I asked her to prepare a poultice of warm ashes and vinegar, and I applied it to my leg, which was already much swollen. The application gave me some relief, but the swelling did not abate. The dread of being disabled was greater than the physical pain I endured. My friend asked an old woman, who doctored among the slaves, what was good for the bite of a snake or a lizard. She told her to steep 12 coppers in vinegar overnight and apply the cankered vinegar to the inflamed part. 1. Footnote 1. The poison of a snake is a powerful acid and is counteracted by powerful alkalis such as potash, ammonia, etc. The Indians are accustomed to apply wet ashes or plunge the limb into strong lye. White men, employed to lay out railroads in snaky places, often carry ammonia with them as an antidote. Editor. I had succeeded in cautiously conveying some messages to my relatives. They were harshly threatened, and despairing of my having a chance to escape, they advised me to return to my master, ask his forgiveness, and let him make an example of me. But such counsel had no influence with me. When I started upon this hazardous undertaking, I had resolved that, come what would, there should be no turning back. Give me liberty or give me death was my motto. When my friend contrived to make known to my relatives the painful situation I had been in for 24 hours, they said no more about my going back to my master. Something must be done, and that speedily. But where to return for help they knew not. God in his mercy raised up a friend in need. Among the ladies who were acquainted with my grandmother was one who had known her from childhood and had always been very friendly to her. She had also known my mother and her children and felt interested for them. At this crisis of affairs, she called to see my grandmother, as she not unfrequently did.
She observed the sad and troubled expression of her face and asked if she knew where Linda was and whether she was safe. My grandmother shook her head without answering. "Come, Aunt Martha," said the kind lady, "tell me all about it. Perhaps I can do something to help you." The husband of this lady held many slaves and bought and sold slaves. She also held a number in her own name, but she treated them kindly and would never allow any of them to be sold. She was unlike the majority of slaveholders' wives. My grandmother looked earnestly at her. Something in the expression of her face said, "Trust me." And she did trust her. She listened attentively to the details of my story and sat thinking for a while. At last she said, "Aunt Martha, I pity you both. If you think there is any chance of Linda's getting to the Free States, I will conceal her for a time. But first, you must solemnly promise that my name shall never be mentioned. If such a thing should become known, it would ruin me and my family. No one in my house must know of it except the cook. She is so faithful that I would trust my own life with her. And I know she likes Linda. It is a great risk, but I trust no harm will come of it. Get word to Linda to be ready as soon as it is dark, before the patrols are out. I will send the housemaids on errands, and Betty shall go to meet Linda." The place where we were to meet was designated and agreed upon. My grandmother was unable to thank the lady for this noble deed. Overcome by her emotions, she sank on her knees and sobbed like a child. I received a message to leave my friend's house at such an hour and go to a certain place where a friend would be waiting for me. As a matter of prudence, no names were mentioned. I had no means of conjecturing who I was to meet or where I was going. I did not like to move thus blindfolded, but I had no choice. It would not do for me to remain where I was. I disguised myself, summoned up courage to meet the worst, and went to the appointed place. My friend, Betty, was there. She was the last person I expected to see. We hurried along in silence. The pain in my leg was so intense that it seemed as if I should drop, but fear gave me strength. We reached the house and entered, unobserved. Her first words were, "Honey, now you're safe. Them devils ain't coming to search this house. When I get you in a missus safe place, I will bring you some nice hot supper. I specs you need it after all this scaring." Betty's vocation led her to think eating was the most important thing in life. She did not realize that my heart was too full for me to care much about supper. The mistress came to meet us and led me upstairs to a small room over her own sleeping apartment. "You will be safe here, Linda," she said. "I keep this room to store away things that are out of use. The girls are not accustomed to be sent to it, and they will not suspect anything unless they hear some noise. I always keep it locked, and Betty shall take care of the key. But you must be very careful for my sake as well as your own, and you must never tell my secret, for it would ruin me and my family. I will keep the girls busy in the morning, that Betty may have a chance to bring you your breakfast, but it will not do for her to come to you again till night. I will come to see you sometimes. Keep up your courage. I hope this state of things will not last long." Betty came with a nice hot supper, and the mistress hastened down the stairs to keep things straight till she returned. How my heart overflowed with gratitude. Words choked in my throat, but I could have kissed the feet of my benefactress. For that deed of Christian womanhood, may God forever bless her. I went to sleep that night with the feeling that I was for the present the most fortunate slave in town. Morning came and filled my little cell with light. I thanked the Heavenly Father for this safe retreat. Opposite my window was a pile of feather beds. On the top of these, I could lie perfectly concealed and command a view of the street through which Dr. Flint passed to his office. Anxious as I was, I felt a gleam of satisfaction when I saw him. Thus far, I had outwitted him, and I triumphed over it. Who can blame slaves for being cunning? They're constantly compelled to resort to it. It is the only weapon of the weak and oppressed against the strength of their tyrants. I was daily hoping to hear that my master had sold my children, for I knew who was on the watch to buy them. But Dr. Flint cared even more for revenge than he did for money.
My brother William and the good aunt who had served in his family 20 years, and my little Benny and Ellen, who was a little over 2 years old, were thrust into jail as a means of compelling my relatives to give some information about me. He swore my grandmother should never see one of them again till I was brought back. They kept these facts from me for several days. When I heard that my little ones were in a loathsome jail, my first impulse was to go to them. I was encountering dangers for the sake of freeing them, and must I be